very, very helpful. So it's getting to the final stages. We're finalizing the script. I'm pretty excited. So this is for high school students and DVD all over the world. So we're doing some filming next week. There's some people coming to interview, Justin Corey, Cliff Burgess, and a few other people. And then the other filming is happening the week after that, and the week after that. We're doing something at an observatory in Toronto, one scene there, and hopefully we're just organizing going to Snow Lab, the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory Lab. We actually have a dark matter direct detection experiment. So if anyone is wondering what we're doing, I would love your input in terms of what you think of the script and the material. I'll put up a URL now, which is actually an MP3 file on that. So that's me speaking out the script because I'll be the narrator. So that goes for about 15, 20 minutes. And so that will kind of, if you listen to that and use your imagination a lot, then that will give you kind of an idea of what the actual thing will be. So it's about 20 minutes. So if anyone is interested, this week would be fantastic. So this is basically what's coming up. So any input is welcome. And in particular, any critical input, because this is something we'll have a PI stamp on, it's going out to the world. So I want people to be tough on me and be critical. It's better to happen now than later. So, actually.
It's your chance to take eternal revenge on PI.
You got the bees? You got the bees? You got the
second? No.
Can you send an email? You can be much more efficient with the address.
Yeah, I can do that. I'll just do that now. Okay, I'll do that.
It was not the right place for like 3 months.
So that was for those who are not reading emails, and I think that's the majority. Today, Bianca wants to give a presentation about what 40 years of the German Democratic Republic did for cosmological conservation theory. Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
So this picture is actually only a reminder that we have May 1st, and in many vision countries, it's a 3-day. Or you were supposed to go on funny demonstration, carrying funny carpets around. But you have actually now to listen to a talk about a Hamiltonian framework for cosmological perturbations to any order in the gauge invariant way. And this is work done together with my student, and it's already published in these two papers. So let me start with an introduction. So the linear perturbation theory is a kind of standard tool in cosmology, giving like a description of the CNB and so on. And the flavor, it's very much like quantum field theory on curve background. And this curve background provides you with a fixed background and also with coordinates. So usually to linear perturbation theory, the issues coming up with gauge invariants are not so severe because you have this fixed background. Now you can ask whether there is whether you can get predictions from the full theory of quantum gravity for the perturbation theory for cosmology. So what you want to have is starting from a full theory of quantum gravity, you want to get the background. So you could imagine that as taking the expectation value of some variable describing some homogeneous features of the universe, like some global scale factor in some vacuum, which we don't have so far, but nevertheless. And secondly, you want to get some predictions for the perturbations. So that would be the expectation values of typically two operators giving you the perturbations in the vacuum. And here we see already one problem coming up in the perturbations. You also want to include some kind of local information, because you want to have correlations between spatial points. But for that, you need coordinates or some way actually to encode this local information. But we have to do it in a gauge invariant way, because in quantum gravity, we are only allowed to operate with gauge invariant observables. So what has been done so far in quantum gravity, more specifically in loop quantum gravity, is to consider so-called mini superspace models. That is, you reduce drastically the degrees of freedom and just consider quantization of, for instance, basically the scale factor. And there it is now, to some extent, how to deal with gauge invariance, because there also the issue of gauge invariance with respect to global time translation comes up. Yes?
Yeah, just a short question to understand. I mean, if I take gravity series as gauge series, a weird gauge filter from a physical group, I mean, I still have the alternative to fix the gauge, but then I'm only allowed to calculate gauge objects. And very often we are not interested in gauge invariant objects. That's the problem.
We are allowed to fix the gauge.
I mean, that's what we do in all gauges.
Yeah.
We have fixed the gauge, we are only allowed to calculate observables which are not affected by the gauge.
Which are not affected by the gauge.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, also in gravity, in the end, the question is just to formulate things you are interested in a gauge invariant way.
Yeah.
So physical observables in the gauge invariant way and relating them to observables you usually do in cosmology. And this will be a way to do that, but usually you don't bother too much because it's complicated at first, but once you sort it out, it may be sometimes more convenient to do it in this way. So then there is some starting work, for instance, by Stefan and Oliver, and maybe Stefan will talk about that today, and by Martin Boyewald and other people, to include perturbations in some way in the theory. And so far, what has been done is to rather take an effective approach to take the predictions which come from the mini superspace model and to write down effective dynamics for the perturbations. And usually this is also done in a some gauge fixed way where you operate with gauge dependent variables. And it's unclear how these things depend on your choice of gauge. So the question arises, how can we describe the evolution of perturbations and background variables in gauge invariant manner? And especially, how can we encode gauge invariant local observables, where local means that usually they refer to some space-time points, but the gauge invariance means here always gauge invariance with respect to diffeomorphism, which transform your space-time points into each other. Furthermore, so these works were mostly done in the canonical framework or in the Hamiltonian framework. So the question is there a Hamiltonian framework for perturbations? And there's one work done by Langlois in 93, but it's non-extendable to higher order, and the other problem is that he gives a Hamiltonian, but the meaning of the Hamiltonian is unclear. And what I mean with that is that it's unclear what kind of time translations this Hamiltonian actually generates, or what the hypersurface is you actually define with these Hamiltonians. The other question is whether there is a gauge invariant framework beyond linear order. And to go beyond linear order, again, I think that the cosmology group knows more about the motivation to do that than me. So there's one group of questions which has to do with back reaction effects and discussion in the literature that these might be partially resolve some problems connected to dark energy. Basically, the idea is that by neglecting back reaction effects, we actually get the wrong, not the, really the correct result for the cosmological constant. But there's also discussion in the literature whether the effects which are so far computed are really physical effects or just depend on the choice of age used in these computations. And also there's cosmologists start to go to consider second order, and there's one question which is, are there any gauge invariants, for instance, to second order? And in 96, von Brunn et al. Had a paper which just discussed the gauge transformations up to second order in the covariant formalism. So what I'm going to introduce is a new framework based on observables. So the central objects in this framework are physical observables, which should not depend on the choice of coordinates. For instance, you could think about to ask for the value of a scalar field at that point where four other scalar fields vanish. This is a question which does not depend on your choice of coordinates at all. And we changed a bit our viewpoint compared to covariant perturbation theory, where you perturb around a fixed background. We rather go into phase space, which is just the parametrization of the space of all solutions to the Einstein equation, and perturb around in this phase space around a symmetry reduced sector describing homogeneous solutions or solutions with huge symmetry. And we will see that the parameters describing the homogeneous features of this universe arise in this theory through some averaging procedure over all degrees of freedom. And that's the reason why this framework is also very suitable to consider back reaction effects, because basically the homogeneous features are included dynamically, and as we will see, we will get quite nice formulas to calculate these back reaction effects.
Also, the perturbations will be homogeneous.
No, the perturbations are inhomogeneous.
So the perturbations will have different symmetries and the background.
The background, yeah. Usually, the background is some homogeneous solutions, some homogeneous solution of the Einstein equation, and you add on this background perturbations or inhomogeneities.
So you can think of that either as if you use a spec reaction, which will change the symmetries of your underlying space time as well, or you can see these things which fluctuate are very subdominant in the energy partial. Then you basically say they have almost no effect on the background perturbations.
But they take you out of the mini superspace.
Yeah.
So the back reaction effects are effects which you have to add to the mini superspace result, as we will see at the end of the talk. If you're patient. Oh, really? Yeah.
But then, as you think of this energy procedure you come up with, this is unique or?
Unique in the, you mean?
I mean, how do you know, how do you calculate your.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Okay. So here's the results, if you want to leave in the middle. So that, to my knowledge, is the first gauge invariant canonical framework for perturbations which is applicable to any order. And we will define the notion of gauge invariant observables of order n. And it allows also the computation, so we have explicit formulas or explicit ways how to compute gauge invariant observables to arbitrary high order. And these formulas can be brought into a Feynman graph-like language. So the evolution is described using free propagation, and free means propagation on the background. And I put it in inverted commas because sometimes it's solvable, but sometimes it's not solvable, and we have to do other approximations like slow wall or something like that. And terms describing interaction processes. Even for the back reaction effects, we get these terms describing interaction processes, and these look quite similar as these terms usually look like. So basically, we have free propagation of modes, then something happens, which in this classical language can be brought into this Poisson bracket with some higher order time evolution generator, and then you have to evolve the result for a certain time and integrate over the time. And we have other terms which basically take care of the gauge invariance. So first I will just say what gauge invariance means in the canonical framework, because it's a bit different from gauge invariance in the covariant picture. And then I will explain how we introduce perturbations and compute these gauge invariant variables, which here are called complete observables, and their approximation. And if there's time, I will explain a bit what the relation to the covariant picture is, and then we'll finish with conclusions. So in the canonical, the canonical formalism, which is the basis also if you want to do a canonical quantization, is nothing else than an initial value formulation. And what we have is, we have given a spatial hypersurface sigma, and we have some initial data on this hypersurface. And then you want to evolve your data, that means just solve the equation of motion, in order to determine what happens at later times. So the phase space is just the space of fields given on some hypersurface, and since we can always evolve these data, we get this phase space represents a parametrization of the space of the space of all solutions to the Einstein equations. And what does gauge equivalence mean? So imagine you have a given solution to the Einstein equation on your four-dimensional manifolds. And now we can just consider two different hypersurfaces embedded in this four-dimensional manifolds. And the given solution induces on your hypersurface different initial data, because these hypersurfaces are different. Nevertheless, if you would take these initial data and evolve them to get the four-dimensional manifold, you will get the same physical solution. So you define to be the initial data on these two hypersurfaces to be gauge equivalent. So that's the definition of equivalence. Two initial data sets are basically equivalent if they lead to the same solution of the Einstein equation of motion, modulo diffeomorphism. And basically, as one can already see here, time evolution actually leads to gauge equivalent sets of initial data. Because that time evolution just means to move the hypersurface up. But still, all the initial data on every hypersurface would give rise to the same four-dimensional manifold. And later on, we will have all these gauge generators, which are also called constraints or time generators. And these basically are just the generators of of these hypersurface deformations. Now, gauge invariant observable just means that it is a function of initial data which gives the same result if it's evaluated on gauge equivalent data. So in particular, it needs to be constant in time, because we have seen that time evolution leads to gauge equivalence set of data, so a function evaluated on different hypersurface representing different times has to be constant. So the question arises, how do we describe time evolution with observables? And that is sometimes called the problem of time, but there is an answer to that, and that is to use so-called relational or complete observables. So these things come with many different names, and have a different disguise along history. They are a bit formalized by quite simple systems, not for, by Cargo and Valley, and I extended these definitions for systems including general relativity. So the idea in general relativity is we define the position and the shape of our hypersurfaces using physical fields, which are called clocks instead of coordinates. And we express the evolution of other fields in this clock time. And we can also get something which would be the clock time generator. That would be the generator which would generate age transformations according to this clock time. So basically the idea is you define, for instance, you take, for instance, a scalar field and define a hypersurface by saying, I consider the hypersurface where the scalar field is constant or equal to some constant tau 1. And then you can ask the question, what is the volume of this hypersurface? And this question is independent of whether you calculate the answer from the initial data on sigma 1 or sigma 2. And if you are calculating correctly, that is. And this value, the volume of the hypersurface defined by this constant scalar field at tau, is a gauge invariant in this sense. And furthermore, you could get time evolution by just changing this parameter tau. So by considering the volume of this hypersurface and of this hypersurface, you would basically evolve the volume in time. Okay. So that was the concept of complete observables. And in some way, we have to approximate these complete observables. And for that, we have actually to introduce what our small parameters are. So we have to introduce perturbations. And the idea here is to chop up our phase space. So the phase space is given us the space of fields on our hypersurface into two sets. Using some operator or some projection operator called P. And this projection basically is this averaging procedure. So we get two kinds of parameters. Once we get, on the one hand, we get the parameters describing the homogeneous features by taking a basic set of phase space functions, like for instance the three metric and the extrinsic curvature, and by averaging it over the rule many hypersurface sigma. So this gives you some homogeneous parameters describing the homogeneous features of the universe. And the rest of the phase space functions, which are mapped to zero by this averaging procedure, will be called the perturbations. So these would be something which you usually would call just the perturbation, so the difference between your real three metric and the background metric, or the back here the background metric really comes from this averaging, and the same for the extrinsic curvature.
Sorry. Is it clear that means that any homogeneous solution then under a random slice, then it will not necessarily give me homogeneous initial data?
No.
So
you're right. So,
here, when you're asking to name homogeneous initial data, you're not restricting to homogeneous space time.
This averaging is defined on an arbitrary solution or for an arbitrary hypersurface.
Yes. And for another very surface, an homogeneous solution could look very...
Also for, yeah, you are right. So you could get also for a homogeneous solution by choosing the hypersurface in a funny way, perturbations. But nevertheless, in the end, the observables we are going to compute are gauge invariant.
So somewhere you should restrict the slice in such a way that
No, the
perturbation. I mean, the splitting is inhomogeneous.
It's a slice dependent statement, but once you have the definition of gauge invariant observables, you can reconsider this question how to define the existence of perturbations in a more gauge invariant manner.
So in some sense, you're both absolutely right, because of Lorossian, the phase space you have now is of course not gauge invariant.
No.
He has to find a gauge invariant completion of this space, and that's what she was going to show. That's of course not a gauge invariant.
So far, and on this level, I just have to introduce what perturbations mean in order to be able to calculate gauge invariant things up to a certain order. Okay, so we have these.
Sorry, you only have two parameters to describe your perturbation since there are 10 degrees of freedom in the metric.
So I forgot that we do the same for metafields if you have them. And these two parameters give you, perturbing.
On the symmetries of the perturbations.
This would be perturbing around homogeneous and isotropic solutions, and for that you would have only the trace of the curve, the trace of the matrix coming out, and the other would be the conjugated variable k is extrinsic curvature. So for homogeneous one, we basically have only the scale factor. That would be q. So q is the scale factor squared. So we have these parameters. If we now you just have the rewritten new phase space into other variables called q, k, and this small h and k, and these give you a slightly overcomplete description of phase space. Overcomplete because these perturbations, if you take them and sum them up and take the trace, have actually to vanish. And now we can take an arbitrary phase space function, for instance, the volume of your hypersurface, and expand it in terms of your new phase space variables. And here, for instance, what happens for the volume, which you would say is some kind of homogeneous variables, you get a zeroth order result, which would agree with the result in a mini superspace model. The first order vanishes because these perturbations satisfy this condition that the trace and the integral over them has to vanish, and you get a second order plus possibly higher orders, which I didn't put here in. But that's also typically how our back reaction terms will show up. It's just that these are induced by dynamics. So we define zeroth order quantities, for instance, by taking q and k, by defining q and k to be of zeroth order. First order quantities are the perturbations in the matrix and the extrinsic curvature. And nth order quantities is any combination with the homogeneous variables q and k and these perturbations to the power of n. So note that we do not introduce second or higher variations, as is usually done in the covariant formalism. We just have these first order variables because they already give you a complete description of your phase space. And the other point is that background variables emerge from full phase space by this averaging procedure.
So in order to define this nth order quantity, you have to make there's a choice somewhere. That is, you have to choose whether you work with H or H inverse or K or the densitized K, or because
That's
the
usual.
Any different choice, which is irrelevant at first order, if I completely change, is it highly non-linear by definition? I mean, so, you know, the notion of nth order is completely dependent on what type of variable you decide to work with.
That is true, but it's the usual definition of, it's the usual problem you have in perturbation theory. But at least we are a bit less ambiguous as compared to covariance theory, because they introduce additionally also second order variation and third order variation. And also this definition is not, it's not invariant under all, at all, so that introduces easy.
So we choose the weight and why?
So here you take just your your basic variables of phase space.
But when you if you work with full observables, it doesn't matter. But when you're going to work with other n observables, then it's going to matter very much. Whether you work with the metric or the inverse metric, whether you work with k or the densitized k, whether you work, and any choice of canonical variable, okay, but the truncation at nth order, truncation at first order is, depends on that. And then you will have to ask, well, is this result dependent on the my parameterization of phase space, or is it, something
but this is a, but this is a problem every perturbation theory has to face.
But do you have one which is better? Which one you work with the metric and the?
I mean, I did the calculation in Ashikaga variable.
Which is even another choice.
Which is another choice from this one. So, so far it works with any canonical pair, but.
So the latter is certainly understand. I mean, in principle, you can. I understand what you said, but you can derive kind of if you have your complete observable, not probability, everything is right. And all what you are now saying, I mean, let's suppose not probability, everything is right. And all what you are saying now, if I do perturbation theory, each term in my perturbation series depends, of course, on the choice of my phase space variables.
Yeah,
I'm
seeing even the notion of what you call second order.
Okay.
Is what you call second order. If I choose another set of variables, I would call that other hundreds. I mean,
that's fine.
So, so you have to check whether the at the end of the day the conclusion you reach is
the same result.
Yeah.
You
have that in any theory which is non-linear. In a theory which is linear, like scalar phi, you have a linear structure. So linear means that you know what one means. So you know what two and three means. In a non-linear theory, that's the problem of gravity. So it's really due to gravity. It's not true in any other field theory.
No, it's in QCD is true as well. Right?
No, QCD is a linear, you have a linear structure, there's a Lie group, so there's a notion of linear structure. So you don't have this problem in English. It's not due to gauge invariance. It's really due to the fact that there's no notion of what is the order one field.
So basically,
The connection is the order one field. It's a linear, linear geography. So there is a linear structure.
It's actually, it's actually already a problem to zeros order because.
So the gauge group is linear, you have a linear structure in the theory.
Yeah, but still, my perturbation theory will still depend on the value of this choice to do the perturbation theory.
Yeah, but you take A is your perturbation, you don't have to split it, so there's no linear ability.
You can add
you better go around zero. You see, better go around zero. So one is the full field. Gravity is the only one, the only place where you have this tricking problem.
So I think it's any it's a problem any theory, any perturbation theory of gravity has to face, and it in some sense already shows up at zeros order. For instance, you could imagine working with canonical variables where the volume of sigma would be, for instance, your basic variables. And just the volume of sigma as it is would be zeros order. But if you work with the scale factor instead, you get actually corrections to the volume of sigma. But if you, all these things coincide to, if you just look at Zero's order or on the mini superstore, the mini superphase space. So we there get the same result. But these two things might change in adding higher orders. So for these things, adding at second order. Whether you have second order corrections already at the kinematical level or not. So, and basically these perturbations are there to define you what is a small quantity. And I think if you compute these physical observables, then in the end you can also make ambiguous sense out of these observables also if you have these ambiguous choices at this kinematical level. Did I say what? I forgot that in the discussion. So Gage-Hilbert observables of order m are invariant under infinitesimal gauge transformations, which are generated by these gauge generators, which deform the hypersurface, up to terms of order m. And I made this definition because, as you will see, it gives you back the things at linear order. And the other is that in this definition, formally we use the full constraints, but actually only the constraints up to order n plus 1 are used. But what is important in this definition is that we do not need to find a closed m-order algebra of gauge generators or of constraints, which is maybe even impossible. So basically what happens in linear theory is that we have a closed algebra, even abelian algebra of these gauge generators. And you can't do that anymore to second or to third order. You don't get a closed algebra of these things. So we just don't need to worry about this problem because we have this definition of Gage-Hilbert observables, which just formally works with the full constraints. And as an example, what are the Gage-Hilbert observables of order m? So we have even a notion of Gage-Hilbert observables of zero's order if you consider just the homogeneous variables. And these coincide with the Gage-Hilbert observables of your fully symmetrically reduced model. So not all zero's order variables are gauge invariant to zero's order. And that's something which comes into, in addition to covariant theory, where the homogeneous variables are just some parameters and you don't define any notion of gauge invariance from these homogeneous variables. You just have A of T or something like that, whatever T means. The first order gauge invariant observables.
So what is the condition?
I didn't say that, but you have a zeroth order. One of the constraints has a zeroth order, so it has to commute with the zeroth order part of your time generator. That is the condition. And that the zeroth order constraint gives you exactly the dynamics of your mini superspace model. So basically,
so
these
Q and P are not solutions of the constraint.
Q and K are not solutions.
You don't get to run solutions. Or do you?
No. I mean you can consider these observables on the full phase space, not only on the constraint hypersurface, if that's what you mean. But what these zeroth order gauge invariant observables mean is that they have to be time constant in time. Already at this level, so you can't just consider the scale factor. Just the scale factor wouldn't be an observer because it evolves in time. Usually, it's time dependent.
I think that Q and K that you choose from the beginning, you don't restrict the solutions.
No, I don't restrict it. Then. No.
Give an example of a zero-order gauge invariant observable rule.
Yeah, I have an example at the end.
I just meant like a parameter that you could.
it would be like if you express the scale factor as a function of the scalar field of the homogene of the average value of the scalar field, that would be a zeroth order observable. So not just A of t or just the scale factor, but taking the scale factor at that moment at which the homogeneous at which the average value of the scalar field has a certain value tau.
Even when you're looking at a zeroth order solution, let's say FRW can be kind of concrete, there's very few things that are time dependent. The scale factor goes as a function of time, the critical density goes as a function of time. The only thing that's constant time would be something that's constrained by the Hamiltonian, like omega, the total density over the critical density. So that really is a time dependent parameter. But when you put in inhomogeneities, it's no longer.
Yeah, I come to that by if we see these complete observables. Like what I just said, the scale factor expressed as a function of the homogeneous value of the scalar field is a gauge invariant because it's not dependent on at which time you basically calculate the scale factor. It's a prediction. It's kind of prediction. So that would be really type invariant. So the first order gauge invariant observables coincide with the usual linearly gauge invariant variables, like for instance the Bardeen potential or the tensor modes. And we are going, or actually we are not doing that, but in the paper we consider first order complete observables. And these are additional invariant under global time translations. So basically, there you have to define something, what you mean with global time, using, for instance, some average value of the scalar field. And in this sense, they are invariant under global time translation just of your initial value hypothesis. And then we can also define second and higher order gauge invariants. And there's a trivial definition, which would be just to take products of first order gauge invariants. But you can also consider higher order extensions of zeros. And first order complete observables. And that would be like the non-trivial extension of these and would give you, for instance, the back reaction effects. And in order to be able to do that, I think that taking there the global time translation into account, the invariants under global time translations, is actually crucial to get second order invariants because basically this global time translation operator generates you already first order terms. Okay, how can we find these gauge invariants to order n? And here we are going to use these relational complete observables. And one can get explicit clock time evolution equations for these complete observables. And there's also power series expansion available. And we will use that to compute complete observables to order n. So we just take these complete observables, which are really encode your physical information with respect to physical clocks. And we just compute them up to an order n. And that will give us gauge invariant observables to order n. And if you expand these observables, we will get a Feynman have like expansion plus terms which take care of these gauge invariant extensions. So for these complete observables, we have to choose clocks. So these are just some phase space functions, or if you would like dynamic functions, which define your global time, or also the just the shape and position of your hypersurface, you ask questions to. And in this perturbative formalism, we have to choose two different kind of clocks, a so-called global clock, which has to start with zeroth order. It's not allowed to have a first order term, but can have higher order terms. And you could take the scale factor or some average scalar field or something, any variable which starts at zeroth order. And these will describe global time translations. For instance, the value of the scale factor usually just increases in many models of cosmology. And you can associate to this global clock time a global clock time generator, which generates deformation of this hypersurface along these global, along the for hypersurface defined by this global time. And then we need many inhomogeneous clocks. So these are clocks which are built from the perturbations. You can take, for instance, scalar field inhomogeneities. So for instance, if you would take scalar field inhomogeneities, in the end, we will ask for the hypersurfaces where these inhomogeneities vanish. Or you can take something which is not so intuitive anymore, which I call longitudinal clocks, because they are related to the longitudinal gauge. And these are some combinations of the modes of the extrinsic curvature and of your matrix. So here we have the longitudinal and the phase of the transversal modes and the vector modes coming up. And one can understand these clocks as giving you the shape of the hypersurface in your space-time manifold. So this would describe or would fix how the hypersurface wants its wiggles around. And you have also gauge generators associated to these clocks, which usually start with first order, then you have higher order terms. And for the global clock time generator, it starts with the zeroth order term, and then the next term is the second order term, plus any higher order giving you basically the interaction terms.
In first order perturbation theory, so you can find the clock anywhere in perfect agreement with standard orthodox cosmological perturbations theory?
Yes, in simple models. One can find a clock which would give you proper time. Mm-hmm. And for chaotic models, it's quite difficult because basically one has to integrate the equation of motion basically to find the clock which would give you proper time. And I think if one could have defined it formally by writing it as an integral, I think. So one could do that. But also, if you use another clock, it's clear basically how you transform from the proper time to another time.
So the global clock time is something equivalent to a Coombe-Brink time.
To
Coombe-Brink time? Is your integrated agent?
To think about Coombe-Brink.
It's not in
there. I have to think what Coombe-Brink time means, but I can discuss it maybe later. We have already that. Okay. I have to hurry up. It takes long. So now we are just taking these complete observables, and here is again a reminder what that means. We have a phase-space function, small f, and we are interested in the value of this phase-space function on this hypersurface. And this hypersurface is defined by saying that the global clock has to be equal to some parameter tau, and varying this parameter gives you time evolution, clock time evolution. And we want all these first order clocks to vanish. So this defines you your green hypersurface at some point in some position in your manifold. And we want to answer this question or define this value of the small f starting from initial data on some other hypersurface. And we want to express this as a function of these initial data. And basically, this result of this function won't change if we evaluate it on the initial data hypersurface 1 or 2. And as one sees here, basically, to get from this initial data hypersurface, one has to do some kind of global evolution with this global time generator. And to take care of these slightly different initial data hypersurface, we have to include gauge amount extension terms, which where these first order constraints or gauge generators will appear. One can give an explicit expression of that in terms of a power series. So basically, this term gives you the global evolution from here to here, and that means the evolution of f with your global time generator for a time which is actually phase-based dependent, because it comes as a difference between this parameter value and your global clock capital T. And then you have to take care of this wiggling, and that happens by including these terms where you have these first or where you have these Poisson brackets with this first order constraints. So this is just to show that there exist explicit formulas for that, but you see that here we get basically power series in these first order clocks, and if you just take the observable up to some order, you just have to chop up the zero, the series at this order, because all these terms, every term is first order, so it would give you a finite series for this gauge amount extension, but we have also to take care of this global evolution. And that's what we, I mean, for BV, for instance.
So this infinite series was just like exponential of your Hamiltonian vector?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You just take the series and expand it to, for instance, second order. And we can do that, for instance, if f is even a zeroth order variable. And that will give you the back reaction terms. So what you will get is, if you do that, a zeroth order term, which coincides actually with the dynamics in, without any perturbations around, so with a minus superspace model, but just a homogeneous result, plus terms which take care of the gauge invariance of the zeroth order term to second order. So these are just two terms, and you have just to make this calculation and to add them up, plus a term which you could see as an interaction term, because it has precisely this form. So you take your homogeneous variables, evolve it in the homogeneous model, and then you get an interaction which is described by your global time translator. So here it means you take the second order of your global time translator and take the Poisson bracket of that, and you will get a term which is second order. So it's a sum of products of perturbations terms, and you take these perturbations and evolve them according to linear evolution equations for these perturbations. So you evolve both terms with respect to linear evolution. So basically, you have free evolution, you have some kind of interaction coming up, and then you have free evolution again of your perturbations. And you have to integrate over the thing. And that is, as I said, exactly the thing how you take care of a perturbation happening at any time in your evolution. And basically, you have here a coupling coming up between the homogeneous modes and the inhomogeneous modes.
Why are the first order terms not part of this calculation?
You can see that they all drop out, the first order terms, because you have this condition that the integral basically of the inhomogeneity vanishes. So then you have another term which is exactly similar to this term, just that we have to replace the zeroth order term by this term. So we have the second order gauge amount extension of this interaction term. And in the end, you get this zeroth order term, which exactly coincides with your symmetry reduced model, plus a second order term, which gives you corrections coming from the interactions and coming from gauge amount extension to second order.
So the integral of the inhomogeneity is must be zero.
That is just how we define this division of phase space. So
I thought it might be the conservation of energies, because for every over density, there must be some corresponding under density. So the integral of homogeneity is just two curves.
No, just that we define that in this way. And Q came from, if you take care of normalization, was exactly that average of the thing. And you want to have, if you take the average of that, you want just to get Q.
Right.
It's this projector definition. Okay, and imagine if you now come up with a vacuum state, then you just get the zeroth order term and the expectation value of the zeroth order term plus the expectation value of the second order term. And since the second order is a product of two things, basically it would give you the expectations of these fluctuations coming from your quantum state as an effect describing the homogeneous features of your universe. So these things can be generalized to arbitrary higher order, and similar formulas can be obtained for evolution of perturbation. And basically, as interactions, one will get similar interactions as in flat spacetime. With that, I mean interactions between the inhomogeneous modes. So for instance, to higher order, you would get mode coupling, which are encoded in your global time translator. And in flat space, there's an explicit example that computed in another publication of ours in 2006. And what you get additionally to flat space is the coupling between this homogeneous and inhomogeneous modes, which give you the back reaction terms, and would then play also a role in the higher order corrections to the perturbations themselves. As a very simple example, a toy model, basically we considered anisotropies as perturbations of a homogeneous and isotropic universe. So you write a metric as something which is isotropic plus something which only has allowed to have diagonal terms. And you see these diagonal terms are small quantities. And it's coupled to a homogeneous scalar field, and that homogeneous scalar field you use as a clock. And then you just can compute your complete observables. And luckily, this model is even exactly solvable, so you can compare all the results. And you see that the zeroth order and second order approximations clearly differ. And nicely, the second order approximation happened to be much nearer to the exact results than the zeroth order approximation. You also see that you get exponentiated differences during the time evolution, and that will be even different if you have really an inflationary universe, because that is just not really an inflation, it's just exponential.
What's in
the axis? Here? Oh, that E, sorry, it's some funny variable which is almost the scale factor of plus. But since we had this thing that these definitions of homogeneous and inhomogeneity depends on your choice of variables, could be lost by Q or something. And this would be the clock time parameter. So we can even make pictures. Okay. So we have this formalism in the canonical framework, but you can relate basically everything to the Gogol picture. In particular, if you just try to think what you are actually computing. And for instance, you can just define what your four-dimensional metric would look like if you adapt it in some sense to the clocks. And to do that, you just take a clock time generator and write it as a combination of the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints as they are usually defined. And in order to do that, you get something which is called Let's and shift, but these things are usually phase-based, turn out in this formalism to be phase-based dependent. So you have to choose them phase-based dependent in order to be able to write this combination. And then you can write the four metric in the usual 3 plus 1 decomposition. And you see that these Let's and shift, you can explicitly compute them once you have the clocks. And you get these Let's and shift coming up in these non-diagonal elements of your metric, in the zero and zero spatial components of your four metric. And that's the reason why I call the longitudinal clocks longitudinal, because the four metric you get for the longitudinal clocks, for instance, has vanishing shift. So the shift is zero for these things. But in order to find a specific description for your Let's and shift, you would have basically to solve this inverse equation. So you would have to find clocks such that you get prescribed values for Let's and shift. And for the longitudinal clocks, if you want to use them to higher order, that's no problem at all. So you can just use the linear clocks for your computation to higher order. But then you would, for instance, get Let's second order for the Let's. Or you could also try to add higher order terms to your clocks such that the Let's function vanishes also to higher order. So that would give you a higher order generalization of your clock. And then, for instance, you can get the Bardeen potential, but by just considering the complete observables associated to the trace of the metric and with these longitudinal clocks. So let me, I will skip over cosmology and let me just end this summary. So this is a Gaetzschenwald perturbative scheme for perturbations to any order based on observables. And the background variables are fully included and are actually needed to define the clock time. And I think it's all that this feature is also crucial in order actually to apply that to second and higher order perturbations. And for this reason, also the back reaction terms arise naturally. And in the paper, we recovered explicitly all the results from linear perturbations. Things which I didn't mention is the definition of physical Hamiltonians and how we can transform between complete observables associated to different clocks, things related to linearization instabilities, and the causality properties of observables. For instance, if you would use the longitudinal clocks, you would get non-local terms starting at third order, and then you would question the interpretation of these observables. And with that, I will finish.
So, what can you say about the debate on back reaction and the instability of back reaction? Some people made the claim that there is a misfight instability.
That there is a what kind of instability?
Infrared instability.
I don't know about that. I know the papers that basically first some people computed back reaction terms in the long infrared limit. Muranov and Brandenberger and other people. And then Unruh claimed that this was just a coordinate effect, or basically that that can, could be rewritten as a coordinate transformation, and that these effects wouldn't be really wouldn't be really observable by local observers. So if you consider like some kind of local expansion rate. And however, it seems to be the case if you then also introduce some kind of local expansion rate expressed with respect to some kind of clocks, in this case scalar fields, that you actually get an effect. So you get an aggregation effect which should be observable.
When you introduce the inhomogeneities in the IQ1 universe, which are...
This is just an isotropic.
Yes, so the inhomogeneities you'll put in on top of an FRW background, right, the fully homogeneous solution, isotropic. And when you put in the IQ1 as the perturbation, so the perturbation still had some symmetry, so you started in a very restrictive part of the mini-superspace where it was just a point.
No, but the model is still in some kind of mini-superspace.
Right, so exactly, so that's why I thought that was quite interesting, that the homogeneities itself led to a PIK type 1 universe. Yeah.
No, the things I add are not inhomogeneous in the sense of inhomogeneous. They are just
anisotropic.
So the things which are the perturbations we add are constant on your spatial hypersurface.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Same everywhere, just in different directions.
Is that a good question?
No.
That's being fired. Okay, then let's thank you.